Welcome to the Wellness Renaissance Podcast, exploring topics to help you find the pieces that fit into your health puzzle.
A private doc who isn't clouded by different sort of motivations, but just purely one motivation, and that is to do what it takes to help people stay home. And so we set up the company with that simple view in mind.
Hey there, this is Judy with Wellness Renaissance and the Wellness Renaissance Podcast. You may be wondering what magnificent utopia the last 14 seconds was describing. Well, let me tell you. The voice you heard was Gray Miller, and he was not speaking of an enchanted land of healthcare far, far away, but one right here in Los Angeles, California. So many cool things are in Los Angeles, California. Gray is the founder of Titanium Healthcare. And to give you insight to the clip, he says the focus is to do what it takes to help people, quote, stay at home. And that is to stay at home and not need to go into the hospital for people with multiple chronic conditions or for those folks to not go back into the hospital after they have been discharged. And yes, they do get their own private doc. And yes, they also get their cell phone number. Gray mentions a pretty thought-provoking, curious, what's going on there kind of statistic in our conversation. One in five people that are discharged from the hospital re-enter the hospital within 30 days. So this number is across the board. So this is not a high-risk population. This is across the board throughout the United States. So it's a pretty astonishing number. A delightful side effect that the work that Titanium is doing is shattering those stats in the area and the population that they're working with. If you happen to find yourself thinking that, nah, maybe this topic doesn't really apply to me, I want to encourage you to listen. If you have ever had a frustration with the medical system at all, perhaps you are going to see a doctor again someday in your life, or you work in the medical profession in any way, not only are there good words of encouragement to remind us why we should be advocating for our own good health care and how to do that, but you might walk away a little inspired and happy and hopeful that there are other people in the world actively working on a vision of better health care for all of us. It seems that Gray has taken that quote quite seriously, and then he has become the change in the world that he wants to see for his family, for himself, and taking a team of doctors, healthcare professionals, patients, and a bunch of others with him. Really quickly, I want to read you their vision and philosophy statements that are on their website. So the vision statement is, we want to create healthcare worthy of the people we care about. Nice. And the philosophy, to do whatever it takes to break through barriers and boundaries to make better processes. Fixes are often not easy and require great tenacity and resolve. He talks about feedback and stats that certainly seem to bear that out, and they've managed to find a way to make it a financial win for everyone, just driven with a little different motivation than what we tend to hear about or know. And their vision includes benefits, and he will explain this to the general population as well. I met Gray at the Believe in Better project that happened here in Duluth, and I think I alluded to that in a previous podcast as well. A gathering of folks that came together to consider what might we do to help our healthcare system work better for everyone. So I hope you enjoy. Strides are being made out there. Why not wherever you're at? Gray's putting himself out there to help you see the vision and to help.
Gray, I just want to start out by mentioning how you and I connected. You were visiting a conference here in Duluth and a magnificent presentation about your work, and that just lit me up, really excited to share that with folks, because I think it's exciting to know that there are people out there doing really great work for the betterment of us all and trying to help us figure this out along the way. So thank you for taking your time to talk with us.
Oh, absolutely. And thank you for calling my presentation magnificent. I appreciate that. I'm honored to hear that word in relation to the work.
let's just start with what is titanium? And then let's back up after we kind of have an idea of what that is and what you've created. And that's a big piece of this, is you are the creator. And then let's go back and talk about what path led you here. So tell me about titanium.
Yeah, so titanium is a relatively new company with a really simple goal in mind, and that is to give people who are at a high risk of going into the hospital or going back into the hospital a private doc who isn't clouded by different sort of motivations, but just purely one motivation, and that is to do what it takes to help people stay home. And so we set up the company with that simple view in mind. And as we contemplated how to build a, call it a business out of it, we really reached for the entities that carry the risk of hospitalization. And so titanium is really focused on health plans, and what we in California have a lot of are independent practice associations, IPAs, like mini health plans. And we contract with them primarily to help people who are at a high risk stay home.
Listening to what you're saying, it's an interesting thing, because the premise of what you're talking about, keeping us out of the hospital, having us not go back, that seems like the logical thing that everybody would want.
Well, you know, it is. And the problem is that in healthcare, you know, the playing field is rife with examples where those incentives really are not there. Mm-hmm. You know, many hospitals are paid to admit. Mm-hmm. So a profitable hospital is one that has a lot of full beds.
Right.
A doctor who is successful has a lot of patient encounters. And sometimes patient encounters act in stark contrast to keeping people out of the hospital. Or hospital revenues would be negatively impacted by not having people in the hospital. So there are different agendas in this capitalist system of healthcare.
So you have flipped things on its head. So tell me then what it looks like in your world to have success, and what is the motivation, and how do you create that motivation?
Yeah, so success for us, really at its basic level, is patients who are successfully functioning at home, because that really is the goal. If you really back up and say, what's the healthiest thing for relatives and family members, is when people aren't in the hospital and they don't need to see a lot of physicians. And so success for us is to give people that comprehensive care program, that absolute passionate commitment to answering their calls, exhausting their questions, explaining their plan of care, explaining their medications. All those things are activities that take time, and that time is the thing that is invested to keep them home. Now, to give you a sense of it, though, there are, you know, the healthcare spend spectrum is really quite concentrated on patients with multiple chronic conditions. Mm-hmm. North of 95% of the Medicare spend is related to people with three or more chronic conditions. And so we know that's the group that really fails in the current system. You know, primary cares generally don't have enough time allocated to those patients with multiple chronic conditions to give them the time to comprehensively explain the plan of care, the meds, you know, the hospitalization reasons, things that they can do about their lifestyle to minimize the risk of hospitalization. So it really is a kind of a focused statement and a lot of activity that goes under that banner.
What a difference I can imagine that you see every day that makes with that kind of focus, and you're seeing results from this model.
Oh, absolutely. And if you imagine, just at a really base level, a person, the kind of people that we see, they're hospitalized, you know, 2+ times a year. They've got 6 chronic conditions. They're on 15 to 20 different medicines. Mm-hmm. And you know, what's amazing is, so a patient who is hospitalized and seeing specialists and seeing primary care, that oftentimes we'll see duplicative medicines. So a blood thinner that was prescribed by their cardiologist, a blood thinner that was prescribed during the hospitalization, a blood thinner that was prescribed by their primary care. And these poor patients who don't know are taking all three.
Right.
And nobody has reconciled the meds because they're not aware of what the other party is doing.
Right.
And so trying to tie all those things together to say, no, you need one blood thinner, and this is the one you ought to take, and then get them back to functional status and back functioning at home with family members' support, understanding the meds and everything else, is a key component to what we do.
Right. I can imagine that for some patients just takes off a load on their, such a load on their body when they're over medicating or medicating, you know, this thing does this, but it's really fighting against this over here. And, you know, and there are other choices.
Oh, totally. You know, one of the big metrics for me, you know, when we started out the company, we have something, Medicaid in California is called Medi-Cal.
Okay.
But we, you know, we wanted to go after Medicare and sort of get our processes figured out. But the first client that we had, you know, 400,000 Medi-Cal patients in downtown Los Angeles, many of which were homeless. You know, so Los Angeles has about 45,000 homeless people, half of which are part of this group.
Uh-huh.
And we, you know, what we realized is, if we could figure it out with Medi-Cal and really focus on these patients who, you know, Medi-Cal tends to be lower income, less support is what we kind of came in thinking, then we can figure it out for other populations like Medicare and commercial. But what's amazing is we've done probably, I think, about 170 surveys of all of our patients who have gone through that clinic. And out of, I'll call it 150 to make the numbers easy, I think we've had three of them that didn't give us 5 out of 5 would recommend the clinic to family members.
Uh-huh.
People are so grateful.
Wow.
That a doc spent 45 or 50 minutes with them, answered all their questions, talked to the family, reconciled their meds, and they really appreciate it. So the surveys and the patient feedback we get is tremendous, tremendous.
Sounds like that's amazing.
Yeah. For us, that's a really big deal because that's the one thing we can point to as to how they feel.
Right.
About the care they're getting. You know, even the staff, you know, what we notice, the way we answer the phone, the way they're treated at check-in, just propriety and human respect. I mean, how many times have you flown on an airline and this flight attendant doesn't even meet you in the eye?
Right.
Or hello, or, you know, instead of saying, here you go, you know, just throwing a bag of pretzels at you. It's the little things. Matter in the whole experience. It's how they were treated.
Yes. Yes. And if they're being seen and recognized and heard, and again, back to that one doc focus, and if that's the kind of attitude you guys are projecting as they walk in the door to the moment they leave, and the population that you're serving, you know, folks with chronic conditions and many times multiple chronic conditions, that's a huge thing for them. And you talked about the homeless population as well, to be treated with integrity and focus. That's life-changing. For people.
You know, it's interesting. I know I said it at the conference, but I thought I'd share it here, that what I would have said going into this whole, you know, startup is that people who were living homeless on the streets would be less compliant, meaning that they wouldn't follow their physician's recommendations, their directions, as well as people who actually had a home. But the feedback our docs are giving us is that it tends to be that the homeless people actually do listen more, that they're more appreciative of the time, and that they pay attention because they've got homeless, there are substance abuse, behavioral health, and on top of all of that, artery disease, COPD, heart failure, diabetes, you know, the long list of all these chronic conditions. And I think they emerge from this experience thinking, wow, somebody really does care.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's a nice byproduct for sure.
Talk about how you got to this point. You're creating this concept, but what led you here? Tell me about your history, because your history is not in healthcare.
Well, yes, indeed. It's funny how you know, if you look back at your life and you kind of, there's a few forks in the road inevitably that people take. And you know, if you look back in your life and you say, well, if I'd have gone left versus right, I wouldn't be where I am. Mm-hmm. And I've got a couple of really big forks in my road, in my journey, that meant something to me. And the first was, of course, that I was, going to be an IT guy. And I was taking my class in with Fortran on computer cards, which basically one card per line, feed them into this card reader. And then if the thing was right, if the program was right, it would work. And if it wasn't, then you had this laborious process of retyping cards and putting them in the card reader, everything else. I dropped my midterm and the cards blew into the wind. And so I just thought, I just don't have the patience. I want to do something, but I don't want to be an IT guy. I think I'm screwed up. And I walked into the recruiter's office in my hometown of Canton, Ohio, thinking, you know, I think the Air Force, you know, I hear good things about it. I don't know anything about the military, but at least I can kind of take a few years, figure out what I want to do with my life and contribute to my country, serve my country and all of that. So I walk into the Air Force recruiter's office and it was lunchtime, this in 1984. And nobody was there. They were all to lunch. And so in that moment, I changed everything. I walked one door down into the Navy's office and started this process of testing and everything else and ended up in the nuclear power program. So instead of taking a break from school, I went to 3 years of school and then served on a submarine for 3 years, a month, and 3 days.
Oof, approximately. That's intense.
Right. And on a submarine, of course, you know, people sort of muse about, well, you know, if I had time for hobbies, you know, I'd be out in the sun every day. Well, I'd be doing, you know, blah, blah, blah. So you just sort of being underwater, you know, 8 to 9 months a year allows you a lot of introspection and thought about what to do when you actually do get out. And so I was certainly motivated to get out of submarines, see the sun every single day and do something. And, so that for me was a big inflection point in my life and in my thinking about career and everything. And then the next one, so I ended up at General Electric for 9 years, dare I say it, back when it was good, when Jack Welch and the whole Six Sigma was gaining traction. It was the most admired company in the world. But I was working with a team in Sweden. And the team was a group of scientists, PhD level statisticians who are working on this credit card portfolio. And the whole premise behind this project was, how do we mail out skip payment coupons? So congratulations, because of your excellent credit history and your payment history, you get to skip a payment this month.
I remember those.
But the whole, yeah. Well, the whole idea was if we mail them out X number of times, I think it was 6 times or something, every 48 days, then we could maximize the yield on this portfolio. Mm. And I thought, oh, man, what have I done? You know, I don't want to, this is not me. I don't want to figure out ways to rip off an unsuspecting public.
Right, right.
And so that was not going to be how I wanted to spend the rest of my life. So I've reached within my purview of General Electric and joined the long-term care insurance division. So I thought that had a great societal role. And it was, you know, from there that I got a big taste for healthcare and figuring out ways to make things better. And so from there, I started up a care management business. This is after I left GE. Focused on mine workers and their families, helping them get care.
Okay.
Which was powerful for me. I know this is a long-winded answer. Then I ended up as a hospitalist company CEO, and that was when my dad got sick. And so he went into the hospital with severe abdominal pain, and they didn't do a CT scan on him. I think it started as a gallstone, and he became septic and nearly died because of a, just call it a domino effect of bad care. And I was a hospitalist company CEO, and I couldn't help him. I felt like, you know, because I wasn't a clinical person, that I didn't have access to the knowledge to be able to challenge what I was hearing. Mm-hmm. I said, wow, you know, I feel like everybody's telling me how it ought to be and how he ought to be cared for. And then I talked to some of my friends who are doctors. They said, well, no, actually, you should be doing this, and current protocol is that. But who is it that can help me? And meanwhile, my dad was nearly dying, and, you know, I was trying to helicopter him out of this hospital where I felt he was getting bad care so I could get him to a hospital that was getting good care. And so in the end, he actually did live, but this whole process gave me this galvanizing thought that people who are stuck need a hand. And if we go back to that basic principle of giving somebody a physician whose sole remit is to help them stay home, stay out of the hospital, that would be a good thing to do. And so that's how I kind of got here. So I'd call it getting into healthcare by braille, submarines to manufacturing plants in China to here I am.
Wow. Yeah, that's quite a journey. Your process of saying, hey, there's got to be something better out there. Like, what was that like, you know, for you trying to bring this idea forward of better care? I assume there was, just because I'm thinking of how the medical system works, I assume there was kind of resistance along the way.
Well, one thing that really helped, you know, at GE, I was a process engineering guy. And so I would go to, for example, motors factories and help them break down processes and figure out how to make better ones. And so that was an important thing for me. And then I got into healthcare, of course, and I was working with physicians and hospitals. And I realized that the way hospitals are paid has a lot to do with some of the problems that we see. In the DRG system, which is Medicare's payment to hospitals, you know, a hospital will get a bucket of money to treat a patient with a certain condition. Mm-hmm. And there's acuity adjusters and all this stuff. But basically, at the end of the day, it's a bucket of money to treat somebody. And because they have a bucket of money, they've got a finite, I call it, line at the end of all of it. It says, when you're done, we discharge you out of the hospital, and that's where our responsibility stops. And so because of that, there's really little, I'll say there's a lot of initiatives that fight this, but I'm going into historical right here, that there's very little incentive financially anyway. Morally is a different story, but financially for these hospitals to see to it that these patients actually successfully transition to primary care. Mm-hmm. And so inside the hospital, a lot of the hospitalists who are doctors who are typically attending physicians in hospitals, they too have sort of a counter incentive structure, but usually it doesn't span farther outside of the boundaries of the hospital. So you got these two things that are absolutely incentivized to get patients through as quickly as possible. And then when they are discharged, of course, it's up to the patient to try and figure out how to get in with primary care and understand their plan of care. And so I knew that coming into it, that was something that just by the very nature of the payment system happens in healthcare. Mm-hmm. And so what I really, if you can imagine a diagram where you've got primary care on one side and you've got a hospital on another, that there's a hole right in the middle of all of that. And that is right where we wanted to play, to catch these patients as they come out of the hospital or ones that are at high risk of the hospital and help them.
And so when does somebody, how do they get connected with you to know that you exist or that they are even able to utilize you?
A good question. So the way, you know, Titanium started is a gleam in my eye. And I'll tell you that it took a year to start up the first clinic. And so there was a lot of discovery along the process about how we were going to create the contracting and share and the responsibility for patient outcomes with our partners and everything else. And, it was a formative stage, you know, because we didn't know exactly how all of it was going to play out. But what we knew was that these health plans and IPAs had patients at a very high risk, mm-hmm. who were untended to. So if you look, and I'll get to your question, but I'm going to digress for a second. You know, I looked at a population of 8,000 people, for example. And, you know, the U.S. average is about $10,000 spent on healthcare per year per person. Mm-hmm. Now, this particular group had $15,000 per person per year. So the population was made up of 8,000 people. And so 15,000 per person per year, 8,000 people, that's about 120 million in medical cost a year. But what was staggering was that approximately 300 of those people were 40 million of it.
Ooh.
And so the concentration of cost, I'm just talking cost for a second,
sure,
is so heavy on these multiple chronic condition patients that if we solve for them, if we help those people stay out of the hospital, that in the aggregate, we free up a ton of money to pay for things that help the broader population stay well. Mm-hmm. And so it's a very clear priority set to get into these people that have these multiple problems and help them be successful. And so the way we got to partner IPAs and health plans was that we started, you know, talking to them about their highest cost patients and readmissions rates, and, you know, which is a key statistic for these folks, the IPA people. So a readmission is basically when somebody goes to the hospital, are they back in the hospital for any reason within 30 days? So it's sort of a good barometer as to how efficiently people are discharged from the hospital and integrated with primary care, and how well the hospital and the post-acute care is operating. But the U.S. average is north of 20%. So one in five people discharged from the hospital are back in the hospital within 30 days for some reason.
Wow.
Which I think is ridiculous. Ridiculous that we have that kind of number across the board.
Right, right. And when you're talking readmissions, is this would a readmission be considered a new event, or is it related to what they were in there before?
Well, this the metric of which I speak is any cause, is what it's called.
Okay.
Any cause, all cause readmission rate.
Okay.
Which means that if they went into the hospital for one thing and they're back in the hospital for any other reason, that's my metric. And
okay.
And the reason I like that metric is because they're sick. They might, okay, maybe this time they have pneumonia and last time they had sepsis. But in the end, they're back in the hospital,
yep,
within 30 days.
Right.
So it's a bit of a severe metric, but a true one.
Sure.
But if you really think about that and focus in on the highest cost patients, then we can get after the where the really, really black hole of spending is happening in healthcare right now, with a view of freeing up dollars for other things,
right,
that we'd like to do.
Benefits us all in the end.
Totally.
Yeah.
Totally. But the way people get into our clinic is, one, we've contracted with different plans and IPAs and even a hospital on Medicare patients, is that they're part of that group.
Okay.
So our readmissions rate, and I told you that it's, I think it's about 21% is the U.S. average, but our readmission rate in Los Angeles on patients in the Titanium Clinic is 1.7%.
Wow.
Right. And so we know that if we do it in the right way, and, you know, we consider any readmission of a patient in our program as a personal failure. Mm. It's a big deal. So there's sort of a collective urgency around it.
Right. That's the key.
You know, even if there's not a clinic, you know, Titanium Clinic, there are things that people can do that they might not even know that they can do when they're in a physician's office, or, you know, with a mid-level like a nurse practitioner or a PA, that can help them. And I was with my daughter a week or so ago, and I couldn't believe this care in this primary care office, where the nurse practitioner walked out of the office, and I thought she was going to get something and coming back, but after about 5 minutes, I figured out that, oh, I guess that's it. And so my blood pressure is starting to rise as I was just aggravated because it was totally about the symptom. There was no follow-up appointment, no follow-up discussion, no plan of care discussion. And I just thought, wow, you know, if this is what everybody experiences when they go in the hospital, then shame on all of us. Mm. And I think that what people need to realize is you can demand good care. You can be your own advocate. And it's okay to be a squeaky wheel to get what you want. You know, and when my dad was dying in the hospital, I realized that there are ways you can get different doctors to help and look, and you can get doctors on the case, off the case. You can be your own advocate. And it all comes down to asking the questions about the care and making sure you understand and making sure you come in with every pill bottle of everything you're taking and demanding that somebody take a look at it and help you understand the meds and whether or not they're duplicative. Because if you don't manage it, nobody else is coming along, maybe, to help you. So, you know, a lot of it comes down to that person's willingness to sort of demand better.
Right. What advice do you have to people who really don't quite know how to do that because they are either tired or they have called and called and asked and been kind? You want to be kind because you know that that's how you want to get results, but you also find that that's how they then say, well, sorry, nope, you can't talk to your doctor. So how do you do this as a patient in a good way and an effective way?
Well, I think that it starts by picking the right doc and picking the right practice. And if you can, I think there's a lot of websites out there that are available, which rate doctors on their communicativeness and their overall perceived quality of care by their patients. And I think it's really important to pay attention to what people say about the physician. I can't misrepresent the fact that we're woefully understaffed in primary care, and it's hard to find good ones. Mm-hmm. You know, there are concierge practices that are coming together where people actually pay an annual subscription to be a part of the doc who can actually then give them the time. Mm. But those are domains of people who have that money to spend. Mm-hmm. And a lot of this falls on people that already healthcare insurance costs are ridiculous, and you know, there's a limited value perception and everything else. But I think even if you are in a situation where you've got to wait 6 weeks to get into that doctor's office, once you're in there, you can manage the outcome to some extent by coming in with your questions, your pill bottles, not letting the appointment be done until you understand your plan of care. In essence, being a squeaky wheel and making sure that you don't get substandard outcome from all of it.
Even just letting people know or reminding people, for some people, myself included, you kind of forget sometimes that you really can advocate for yourself and that you really do deserve to have answers.
It's so easy to assume that if it came out of the mouth of a healthcare provider, that's it. And, you know, I think the internet helps us a lot because we can ask questions, and I think questioning is healthy.
If with your somebody coming into your clinic, talk a little bit about just what does that visit look like? You're trying to keep them out of the hospital. So is this a clinic that, you know, do you have beds? Are people staying overnight to manage their care sometimes? Or is this a longer visit?
Yeah, so first, the way they come to us is they've been identified as somebody who's coming out of the hospital, for example. And what's beautiful is that sometimes people can come out of the hospital more quickly because the doctor in the hospital wants to know that this patient is going to be seen. There's a key window of time after somebody leaves the hospital in which a follow-up appointment is vital and statistically significant in lowering readmission rates. And that's within 72 hours. And so We make it a point to see him next day if we can, and to see him in the clinic. So when the patient comes in, we will have already gotten their course of treatment, you know, the chart, hospital charts, the labs, some vital information that we have that we can get to be adequately prepared to see the patient. When they come into the clinic, you know, for us, it's not a busy, crazy clinic. We actually focus and give people, you know, our average new visit's 50 minutes. So we focus on exhausting the evaluation of these people and what they need. Mm-hmm. So they come in, it's there's no overnight beds or anything. It's really an outpatient. We can help them with family issues. We help refer to specialists, but it's a pretty comprehensive visit once they get there, and we can help them with all their meds and everything else. So
I think of it as so great because, you know, when you've been in the hospital and you're leaving, you're like in a mindset, there's a lot going on, you're stressed, you're probably not feeling great. And whether you have help or not, there's a lot of information there. And to know that you're going to walk out and get your time to think of those questions.
Oh, totally. Well, and sometimes people will go in the hospital and they'll hear that they have cancer. And, you know, cancer is one of those such a scary word that the patient will leave the hospital and they'll be reeling, terrified. Not really able to process a lot more than dwelling on that word cancer, you know, which to most folks means, man, this is going to kill me. And so there's this terror. And so, you know, to be able to deal with some of those kinds of feelings and helping them understand, you know, some of the statistics around recovery rates and what they can do. And it's key. So there's some of it's medicine and helping them with the medicine reconciliation and the comprehensive visit and make sure that everything's covered. Some of it is sleuthing and finding difficult diagnoses where they might have been overlooked in the past. And a lot of it is the emotional side of things and helping them understand or helping their caregivers understand. Some of it is, you know, that they are actually on a one-way track and that they're not going to recover, and helping them grapple with that and advance care planning and some of the difficult conversations that need to be had with people who are terminal.
That's fantastic. And that's so huge. And a lot of people don't know where to go for that. Very needed.
Yeah.
Wow.
I would be just like that if it happened to me. Oh man, cancer.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, who wouldn't? Who
right,
wouldn't feel like
right.
that?
Yeah, yeah. You hear the big word and everything after that is just a blur, you know?
No, totally.
You
totally.
Need time to process. The 50-minute visit, which is amazing. And part of that I'm imagining is that you're listening to their experiences, what they have done, trying to figure all this out. And I know this may not apply necessarily to some of the populations that you're working with, but I'm thinking of folks who might be looking at their healthcare desires for themselves from a perspective of bringing in maybe integrative medicine or quote unquote alternative or that kind of thing. How welcoming are you to those conversations?
Yeah, for us, you know, there's a lot of, I'll say, prevalence of alternative medicines in California in particular. You know, there's a lot. There's Western medicine approaches. There's Eastern medicine approaches. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that one of the nice things about living out here is that there's a collective receptivity to it. And so we can help them understand various treatment options and some of the pros and cons. There's some cases where I believe Western medicine is absolutely the right answer. Mm-hmm. And sometimes not.
Right.
And our practitioners are versed in that. And so we just try and help the patients understand what their various options are.
And being open to that mindset is such a huge help because it allows people to share with you guys and be honest and be open about here's what we're doing, here's what we want to do, here's what we've done to integrate that into the care that they're doing or take it into consideration.
Yeah, and you know, in the end, I think that if we can leave them with a knowledge of, hey, you know, if people want to know, well, most people anyway, want to know, okay, I'm taking this drug and this is what it's doing, and some rudimentary knowledge about why and what and how, and you know, I think most people, when it comes to their care, particularly when they're sick, really sick, they want to know. Okay, here's my situation. Here's some things I can think about I want to do or I don't want to do, and really having a pretty comprehensive look at it.
And you said earlier, you talked about the stats. Obviously, your statistics are pretty darn amazing, and that being a huge driver. But what about, if you don't mind sharing, what about your fee structure? You know, like we've talked about the driver for hospitals and clinics and doctors who are only allowed to spend X amount of time with a patient because they don't have any health issues. And so it's all about money. How does that fee structure work with you guys in a general sense, and maybe even just the folks that you're working with, so everybody feels good about it?
Yeah, you know, well, first, if we start with the spirit of all of it, then we can get into the letter, you know, the broad idea, and then the specifics. Really, I think that it's a bad decision to make healthcare inaccessible for people. And when I say inaccessible, I think that barriers like heavy fees, transportation difficulties, bureaucratic processes, but those things are really inhibit people's access. And the more of those barriers that we can remove, the better job we'll do of actually getting people to a person who can treat their problems. And so philosophically, we believe that to help people as much as possible, that we can remove the barriers. And so our fee structure really is between us and the plan or the IPA or the hospital. Mm-hmm. Of course, their co-pays may apply. That's something we just have to do. Mm-hmm. But for example, in the Los Angeles clinic, you know, we're not collecting co-pays from these people. And, you know, we're paying for their parking. We'll help them with transportation. And so, you know, we really work to make it so easy for them to get access to care. Mm-hmm. And so that's a big component for us. So as far as the patient's concerned, they've got somebody who can give them that time without the convoluted aspects of a lot of paperwork and a lot of pre-authorization and a lot of, you know, check writing or expense on their part. And I think that's an important ingredient to success in healthcare.
Right. Well, you're taking away so many of the barriers and the monotony, be it paperwork or be it transportation. I mean, those sometimes are really huge pieces for people.
Well, totally. And if you think about, you know, and I started with this gleam in my eye was, you know, what would I want for my mom or my dad or my stepdad? You know, how would I design healthcare knowing that they all of them were in the hospital in this period of time when I was starting this company. Mm-hmm. And they just couldn't, you know, I couldn't get access. They couldn't, it's like, how would I build a company to give them the kind of care I would want for somebody I truly care about? Mm-hmm. And the answer is, I want somebody to help them get to the appointment. I want somebody to call them up afterwards, make sure they're okay. I want somebody who's going to make sure that they understand every pill they take and how important it is not to, you know, adjust the dosage by themselves, which is something my mom likes to do. Right? I'm like, Mom, you can't just do that, you know? She said, well, I think that I need to take a little, you know, it's like, well, no. But, you know, that's the kind of thing that really started the whole process.
So that's the spirit of things. Can you talk a little bit more about the fee structure aspect of things, just to understand how that is driven forward for you guys?
Sure. You know, so as I mentioned, we've got, you know, these risk populations. And for us, you know, obviously we have to be able to pay the doctor a competitive salary to make the whole business work. We have to cover our costs. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, the way we approach our contracting really is by being able to share in the benefits we create, that what we do is we create in pools and cost structures that when we make a difference like that, you know, some of the money that we've helped them save comes over to Titanium. And so we've got, it's really a twofold fee structure. You know, one is enough to keep the lights on, and the other is an incentive structure.
To keep people healthy.
Yeah, and it ranges, you know, but again, you know, healthcare already has enough financial sort of differences and incentives and everything else. And what we really strive to do is to put our margins where our mouth is. not to charge exorbitant fees for doing a poor job, but to charge enough and to get incentive structures that allow everybody to win. You know, because our docs, you know, they're going to be, we have one the other night, you know, and she went over to the emergency room to try and help a patient stay out of the hospital. It was 6 at night and she was there till 7:30 or 8. You know, these are hard things to do. You know, and healthcare is one of those things where it's a person helping somebody in need and trying to facilitate that connection. But at that intersection, there's a lot of tough work to be done. And so what we're really trying to do is help them be compensated for the value that they create to the broader system.
Wow. And I'm betting that for many of them that work for you, that's they're doing what they wanted to do as a doctor. Like they can really dig in and help people.
It's so just so perceptive. Yeah, absolutely. You know, there's so many examples, but here's a couple. You know, in some hospitalist practices, for example, a doctor will do a 12-hour shift. And that's it's a 12-hour shift where they come in and there'll be patients waiting to be admitted. And so the day starts on their feet, and then 12 hours later, they're still cranking. And they will have seen, you know, well, they, some of the standards talk about 15 to 20 patients in a day. So even if you said that number was 18, that's a patient and a half an hour while they're in the hospital. A lot of them see more than 20 patients, you know, a couple an hour. And so it's on their feet, and these people are sick. You know, they're in the hospital because they're sick.
Right.
And so they're exhausted. They're exhausted. And so they come out of this 12 hours later, and then they got another 12-hour shift and another 12-hour shift. So they do 7 12-hour shifts in a row, and then they get 7 off. Mm-hmm. And so it's a really tough schedule for these folks. And so when they hear about something where they can spend the time they need, they can practice the medicine that they really wanted to practice and really uncover a lot of the issues with patients and help them, it's really attractive. The other side is primary cares. You know, I've heard stories seen where for some primary cares, they've got a clock. And so the practice will remind them, they've only got 7 minutes to spend with this patient, or 5 minutes, or 10 minutes. You know, they've got a chess clock kind of mentality about how much time they can spend with patients. And there's this frenetic pace that's happening in the office. And a patient, you know, they'll see 25 to 30 patients in a day. Mm-hmm. And so and then you've got paperwork on top of that.
Right.
So, yeah. You know, they hear about titanium and they think, wow, you know, this is really something that means a lot because this is the kind of medicine I want to practice. And so for them, it is a compelling proposition.
That's very cool. Like, yay for you for creating that environment. That's awesome. I have questions for you.
Uh-huh.
Last questions. The first one is, so we talked about how as a patient, do we go in and advocate for ourselves a little bit. Is there anything you can give to people who are working in healthcare, whatever position they may be in, or is there anything that they can do? They may not have the means to start up what you've started up and use your model, but what can they do in their everyday life to help bring things up to this mindset, even just a little bit?
I think it's such a great question. You know, a lot of it, when somebody finds themselves in a situation like what I described, where they have that pace and that pressure and the system is not acting in the big goal. And the big goal is that, you know, a happy, healthy society is one that doesn't have, you know, people in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Let's start with that one. It kind of makes sense that hospital is sort of an area of last resort. And in California, a lot of hospitals have what are called capitated arrangements or global risk contracts, where they've partnered with health plans where they get paid regardless of whether patients are in the hospital or not. Mm. So imagine that. So a hospital who's in a capitated relationship is really looking to help people stay out of the hospital. Mm-hmm. And so that's an example of a health entity that has entered into a relationship where they can creatively work with risk entities like IPAs and health plans to help people stay home. CMS has CMS being the Center for Medicaid, Medicare Services, they've got numerous initiatives that are out there that are programmed to help change the system. And there are a lot of really well thought out structured programs. For example, this Bundled Payment for Continuous Improvement Advanced Initiative. It's called BPCI. And in it, what hospitals can do is volunteer for a program where instead of the hospital having this finite line at the end of the discharge, hospitals are able to participate where they're responsible for not only the costs of hospitalization, but a Medicare calculated cost 90 days after the patient's done with the hospital. So here's a long, in a 90 plus day episode where Medicare is calculating all these different costs. And some of the forward thinking hospitals are out there saying, well, okay, what really happens inside a SNF, a skilled nursing facility? You know, we get these readmissions. Let's work together to figure out how to make the process work better. And participating hospitals stand to get a check for the reduction in cost. You know, so I think there's a lot of people out there and a lot of, call it tailwind, towards rethinking some of the traditional models in healthcare to get to a better output. There are some that fall short. You know, CMS had a readmissions penalty program, which was designed to hurt hospitals who readmit patients. But the problem is they use 3 years of data in a fraction that the hospitals, many of whom just don't feel like they have a lot of hold on it. And instead of penalizing the real readmission, what Medicare did was discount the entire fee structure. So it's almost like an assumed discount on everything, but the actual readmission is still a revenue event for the hospital. Mm-hmm. So there's instances where we've got more work to do to drive the right behavior within the system. But as a practitioner who's out there frustrated and wants to make a better way, there is a better way. And it may be that the organization which they are a part hasn't yet figured out how to change the financial arrangements or change the incentive structure to help them do that. But starting with awareness and the conversations and saying, oh, you know, what if, you know, we're a primary care, what can we do to help out, get more capacity, help people understand, decrease the volume through the clinic so that we don't have to see as many people. I'm a continuous improvement believer. Mm-hmm. I think if you ever stay static in a day and you're not rethinking processes, you're not thinking. And so for me, I think there's this need to continually improve these delivery mechanisms. And so I think it starts with this grassroots want on the part of the people who are out there and so frustrated because they see it. They see these patients coming back and back and back and mm-hmm. back. And they know there's got to be a better way.
Keep asking questions. Keep bringing up ideas. Keep thinking forward. And if anybody, totally. You know, when I hear the words, well, that's the way we've always done it. It's like, no.
That's one thing I'll say about General Electric in Jack's day. You know, I joined because Jack Welch was the CEO, and it was this time of just absolutely challenging the status quo. You know, everybody at GE had these value cards, and it was, you know, Jack Welch in his prime. You know, it was GE leaders hate bureaucracy and all the nonsense that comes with it. Mm. GE leaders challenge the status quo. It was almost this revolution of, why are we doing that? Why do we have this time card? It's so stupid. And I loved it for that. Mm-hmm. I think that's what people have to do. So wait a second, stop. We're not, that's stupid. I don't care if we've been doing it for 20 years. It starts there.
Right. What else am I not thinking to ask you or that you want to share about the work you are doing, have done, or Titanium?
Well, you know, Titanium exists. You know, for us, what we really want to do, we're looking to grow our practice. You know, Titanium is, you know, we started it the very end of 2015. And so it's early days. We've got clinics in Los Angeles, but we'd like to grow and we'd like to help. You know, I was in Minnesota because of this Believe in Better project. Mm-hmm. And, you know, what I left feeling was there are so many people who are frustrated. When we look at the costs of our country, and we didn't get into it, but we pay 2 to 3x what other people pay in other countries. And we're not even getting better life expectancy. We're getting just really ripped off.
Right.
And so, you know, I think there's always an opportunity to build these kinds of practices. And obviously, Titanium Healthcare is here as one potential to help make the system better. And so, you know, but if people feel like they're ready to challenge the status quo and they need help, then we would obviously be interested in helping. So
that's beautiful. You know, I love it. I love the idea that I hear a lot of times when these conversations of frustration get brought up of, well, we have it so much better than other countries and think of how much better we have it. And I'm always like, we can do better than this. Some of these answers, some things are hard. This is a big and hard one, but there are simple things sometimes within the complexities that can be done that would not be that difficult in my mind to do, but a mindset has to shift. And we do not need to go to the lowest common denominator of, well, we have it better than somebody else. It's like, that may be true, but there's a lot of ways we really don't. Like you're saying, look at statistics. It bears out that we don't. And if you're the person living in that statistic, it's not so great. So if somebody wants to learn more about you, think about you guys as a model, how do they do that?
TIHealthcare.com. And, you know, certainly an email to me would be welcome.
Fantastic.
Thank you for investing your time and your passion about making healthcare a better place for all of us. I think it matters. We're all trying to get to a better end. So thank you for putting together this podcast.
Thank you. Thank you for being a part of it. And you know, not only the creative mind and the chutzpah to go forward and say we can do this differently, and then to put your actions where your ideas are and make it happen, but then to travel and to share with other people what's going on and what you're doing and your mindset and your care for the individuals and your inspiration. Because I think all those things really, really do matter. And yeah, I mean, part of my concept with the podcast is to help get this out there so that people can be inspired to do something different, whether it's for themselves and their own healthcare, but for the bigger system, because it's a huge painful mess. As anybody knows, when they're a patient, if you're not lucky enough to be in a fantastic place, and when you are, it's amazing. And you're probably not as, in a sense, grateful as you should be, but at the same time, it's kind of like, but that's what it should be.
Totally. Yeah, I agree.
So, we need to raise our standards. So thank you for helping us do that and for doing it for all those people out there who I'm sure are so loving your work.
Thank you again, Judy.
All right. Have a great day.
You too.
And again, if you want to check out Titanium Healthcare's website, it's tihealthcare.com. T-I, just like on the periodic table. So, funny story that I want to share that Gray shared at the Believe in Better conference that I actually, and maybe this is just my twisted way of seeing the world, but I think this actually speaks a lot to the results and outcomes and the way they leave people feeling. He was talking about the surveys that they get and the high numbers that they get, and they have portions, of course, where you fill in and you make requests for things that you might like. What would you like to see improve? What things would you like to see? And somebody wrote in that they thought it would be beneficial to have a stripper. And he said that, you know, that they really do try to accommodate requests, but this was one that they didn't feel that was so appropriate to fulfill and accommodate. And I thought, you know, the person must have been left feeling pretty darn good and in a really good space, because I have filled out multiple forms like that about my medical experiences at hospitals and clinics, and I had to be in a pretty happy space to make that request or even that joke. I've certainly put some silly commentaries on forms, but I'm usually in a pretty good place to do that. You know, one other comment that I want to make before I send you all on your way. I absolutely know that there are people within these systems that we have that we struggle with. There are fantastic doctors and nurses and staff who are the people that you want to get in to see. They're the nurse you want to get, the front desk person you want to talk to, because you know you're going to be heard, you're going to be listened to, and you're going to get the help that you feel like you need. And I know the other people in the system who are not necessarily doing that may darn well want that, but they have a lot of pressures coming down on them that are superseded by the patient calling in and my needs. And they have other matrix and goals they have to hit that maybe are in line with mine, but maybe are contrary. And that doesn't make them bad people. It makes them overworked and stressed. But here's the thing. I want to hear more about clinics and systems where they're doing the right thing, or that really the holistic concept is, I want to go to that clinic because everybody there is working towards my best health, and the system around the people is working towards my best health and my wellness. I want the people that I talk to that are in my classes, the conversations that I hear, where those folks aren't trying to find out from each other, who do you go to and how do they talk to you and what happens? Then you just say, hey, check this out, check this place out. Everybody there is great. Maybe you mesh better with some of the folks, but generally you're going to walk in and you're going to feel like you're getting what you need. I have such sadness and concern adding to all of the stories of situations that I hear from so many people. I have my own experiences at a couple different clinics that I really thought were the bomb and pushing forward and really serving me and the public. And they were these unique little spaces. And I feel like I've watched entropy happen. And not just me. These are other people at the same clinics who are having these same experiences and these same feelings. I refuse to believe that this is just the way it has to be, that this is the best we can do. Gray, other people at that conference and other people around prove that we can do better. So for the sake of our health, our wellness, our sanity, let's try to figure this out. On that note, thank you so very much for listening. Check out the rest of the podcasts and topics at wellnessrenpodcast.com. There you can join the email list so you're aware of new episodes as they come out. If you like what you hear and you like what we're doing here, please consider supporting the podcast by sharing the podcast via whatever method floats your boat. Maybe that's Facebook. Maybe that's passing forward those emails. Yes, you are welcome to forward them on. If you like what you hear here and you like the work that we're doing, please consider financially supporting us through becoming a patron on the website through Patreon. And I am definitely sending out deep gratitude to the newest person who hopped on as a patron this last week. Thank you so very much. And really to all of you who support the podcast in whatever way, it really means a lot more than you can probably imagine. So thank you. Until next time, may you find more pieces that fit beautifully into your health and wellness puzzle. Be well.